I was in a coma for 6 weeks while the doctors told my wife I was going to die. When I woke up, she told me the most fantastic story. My team kept running the business without me. Freelancers reached out to my team and said, "We will do whatever it takes as long as Craig's in the hospital." I consider that the greatest accomplishment in my career. My name is Craig Andrews, and this is the Leaders and Legacies podcast, where we talk to leaders creating an impact beyond themselves. At the end of today's interview, I'll tell you how you can be the next leader featured on this show. Today, I want to welcome John Scott. He is a CPA, an AEP, and a CGMA. I don't know what all that means, but it sounds interesting. He is also a partner in tax at Anders and a leading authority in law firm financial management. He has over 30 years of experience, and he heads Anders' legal industry efforts for their virtual CFO team, offering law firms the dedicated resources, forward-looking financial insight, and critical thinking they need to thrive. John is also the author of Judicial Dollars and Cents. He specializes in helping firms optimize processes, improve profitability, and position themselves for successful succession or managing partner transitions. John, welcome.
Thank you, Craig. Great to be here.
So I have to ask, what do all those letters mean? I know CPA, I think everybody knows that, but what do the rest of those letters mean?
CGMA is a Certified Chartered Global Accountant. It's a designation that the AICPA has. AEP deals with trusts and estates. They're just designations along the way that demonstrate an expertise in a certain area. I mean, at Anders, we work with high net worth individuals, and a lot of those are attorneys. And so beyond the firm finances, you want to talk about their own personal finances and their estate planning, and that's what those things deal with.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's an interesting trait about attorneys. Nobody's going to deny that they're anything other than exceptionally brilliant. You know, they're very, very smart. But it seems like there's some things, some areas where they struggle.
They are very smart, and they have been trained to box you in with words, which I love and appreciate. But one thing that they lack in their undergrad and in law school is most of them do not have a finance or accounting background. So when it comes to logic, they nail it. Okay. When it comes to finances, they don't quite get it. And they need, in my opinion, a little bit of help to figure out the financial part of it.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things, so we used to market professional liability insurance for attorneys. And, you know, some of the content we generated was we had something called the lawyer's MBA. And it was all based on the premise that I heard lawyers say, hey, in law school, they don't teach you the business of law. They teach you law, but they don't teach you the business of law.
Yep. A lot of times you'll look at the bank account as a law firm owner and you'll say, wow, there's a big balance in there, not realizing that next week is payroll, the rent's due. So that money's already accounted for and you can't just take it out. If you do take it out, you know, the worst thing I could ever do to a law firm owner is say, hey, we told you could take that distribution last week, but now you got to put $50,000 back in so we can cover the rent and payroll. And that's just not how we plan. We like to not be historical in nature, but have good current data so that we can forecast at least the next 12 weeks and say, okay, here's the cash we know is coming in. Here are our known expenses. Here's the excess cash that's available for a distribution.
Yeah. Which I'll be honest, that's valuable. That's something I've struggled in my own business, understanding to be able to look at. And it's very easy to look at the chunk of cash sitting there, but to be able to look forward and say, okay, what's this mean? How much of this can we use to either do a distribution or reinvest in the business?
Yeah, you really have to know what the value drivers or the revenue drivers are. Those are the levers that you can pull to increase that cash position. I mean, you could slow down paying payables A lot of big companies, when they make a merger, Anheuser-Busch did that here. When InBev acquired AB, they said to all the vendors, "Hey, we used to pay in 30 days. Guess what? It's going to be much longer than that." That was a way for them to increase their cash and pay off their debt early. So firms have that same thing. If they have good billing hygiene and send out bills on a regular cadence and have good clients, train your clients to pay those bills within terms, then you can increase that cash position. If it's an hourly billing firm, let's monitor and manage those hours that folks are billing and get bills out on time. If it's a PI firm, let's close cases. Let's not have little hiccups where cases kind of lag and somebody forgets about it. Let's manage that process and get the cash flow wheel flowing.
You said something that triggered something in me. I do something that I think many find to be weird. And I would imagine a lot of CPAs find to be, or CFOs find to be abhorrent, maybe worthy of being put in the stocks and, publicly mocked for doing it. But I decided a long time ago that especially with my 1099s, and I'm in a business where we rely heavily on 1099s, that I'm going to try to pay them faster than anybody else, to the point where there have been times where I've gotten an invoice in and I immediately stop. It will pop up in the email and I'll immediately stop what I'm doing and pay them to make
I
that.
think that's actually smart because it might not be the best use of your cash, but the next time you need that contractor, you're an A client to them because you pay by return mail. I mean, we have the same set of clients, and the client that you have to pester to get paid, they're not an A client, but the one that sends back by return mail the check, you're going to pick up the phone call, you're going to bend over backwards for that person, and your contractors are going to do the same for you.
Well, and they have. I have one who was it's somebody a somebody an exceptional marketer was
Bless you.
an exceptional marketer was trying to poach her, and one being nefarious about it, and somebody came up who was kind of brokering it and came up and talked to me about it. And I said, look, this is a huge opportunity for her. The last thing I'm going to do is hold her back. And she happened to be walking by right then and say, hey, there's a conversation we need to have. Here's this opportunity. And she listened and she thanked him and she said, no, I'm going to stick with Craig. And we were talking, and I told her privately, I said, you should really think about this opportunity. It's very, very good. And she said, no, I'm loyal to you.
Well, and that speaks to your leadership. You have surrounded yourself with good people and you treat them well. I mean, I think that you're being influential and not overbearing. You're not being difficult to work with. You're actually really helping them out, and you pick the right people. They fit your culture. They're good at what they do, and that's what we all need to do to build our organizations because we want those organizations to go beyond us.
Well, the thing that shocks me, because I've seen, a lot of businesses play the game with, hey, we pay, so when the pandemic hit, Dell reached out to all of its suppliers and said, hey, by the way, immediately you're on 80-day terms. And the thing that surprises me about that is, at least in critical elements of your supply chain, and if your supply chain is talent, as it is with me, or your supply chain is, bits and pieces that go in computers, as it was for Michael Dell, it seems like that is disruptive behavior to your supply chain.
It was disruptive, and the pandemic was dire times. People made good decisions and people made poor decisions. I think the way you're treating your contractors is the way we like to treat our employees. We like to think that we are paying at or above market. We want to give them flexibility to, and we only hire the smartest people. I mean, we want people who are really good at their job, but we also need them to buy into what this organization is trying to do. And that means we give them flexibility. They can work from home. They can work fully remote. They can work part-time remote, part-time in the office. We want to give them as much flexibility as possible so that they stay. I mean, the worst thing you can do is have high turnover because you're constantly training. You don't know who the next person in the door is going to be.
Well, and it's costly to retrain them, and like you said, you never know what the next, but just it takes time, and it's expensive to train somebody, even if they're already good, bringing them in and getting them familiar with what you do and how you do things.
That's actually the value proposition of what we do. We provide a team of finance people for a firm at a fraction of the cost it would have to hire that team internally. And there's no long-term commitment, and we have a menu of services that you pick and choose what you want to keep, what we do, and the price changes by what you say yes and no to. And if 3 months down the line you say, "Hey, I'd like you to take over accounts payable," we flip the switch, change the statement of work, and the price changes. Or conversely, you say, "Hey, I'm going to take back accounts payable." We flip the switch, no big deal. We move forward with a lesser price. So you're not taking the risk of hiring the right team, training them, getting them up to speed. You know, if you make a bad hire, it could be 18 months before you figure it out and correct it.
I worked for a company years ago that we hired somebody that they didn't report to me. They were based in Taiwan, and they came back to the factory, and I was meeting with this person. I figured out pretty quickly that when he didn't know the answer to something, he would make something up. And I went to my GM and I said, "We can't let this person meet with customers." And so I ended up going to talk to his boss, not my GM's boss, but and it was funny. I ended up losing a little political clout in that because everybody thought I was just being mean and harsh. I said, "You need to give him some time. You need to give him some time." And so he worked for us for 3 years until one of our competitors hired him away. And I was in a fairly small industry. We did semiconductors for mobile phones, and so we knew each other. And a few years after that, I was having some beers with the guys that hired him away, and I said, "Hey guys, I meant to send you a Christmas card to thank you for hiring away Sam." They're like, "Oh, he was horrible. We fired him within a year." I said, "Yeah, you're the smart ones. We kept him on for three."
Well, and that's happened to us where somebody in the organization has been hired away by a client and it didn't always work out. And like, well, you never asked me, you just poached him. And, you know, he was probably one of our lower performers anyway. But the other thing you said was, and I'm freezing on it now. I know. I always tell young people in our organization, "Hey, if you come into my office, bring a pen and paper. All right. I want you to take notes so that you comprehend what we talked about." And then alternatively, when you don't know the answer, the best answer is, "That's a great question. Let me figure it out and I'll get back to you." And there's no shame in saying that. In fact, I think it's respected by whoever's asking the question that you care enough to say, "I don't know. It's a great question, and I'll go figure it out."
Making something up never works out, never pans out.
Yeah, it usually ends up burning you because it was wrong.
Well, and I'm curious, there was something you mentioned because I've had m multiple discussions about this in my business in terms of having kind of non-solicitation clauses with contractors and various things. How do you handle that?
Honestly, you know, we have them. We have non-solicitation and non-compete clauses. So you can't really leave here and take clients without paying for them. But we also have with our vendors and our clients that they won't solicit our employees. And other firms, we have these agreements. They're not really written agreements, but we won't poach your people. But it happens. I mean, especially it's slowing down now because the market for jobs are slowing down. But when you could get a phone call and 2 days later be making $15,000 more, it was a flywheel of things. And even though we have these agreements, they're really tough to enforce. It's got to be respect and honor between competitors.
Well, Well, and I think ultimately it goes back to how you treat your employees. And there's some that will just leave. There's some that you're happy when they leave, but there are some that will just leave. But I think the best form of security is to build an environment where they don't want to.
Right, and build a culture that they love. And we've had a lot of boomerang people. They did leave. They took the shiny offer for a little bit more money. 6 months to a year later, they come back.
Yeah.
But if you didn't want them back, you're like, oh, sorry, don't have any room for you. There also is this generational difference, right? There's a guy, Chris DeSantis, that wrote a book about why I find you irritating. And it's the bias that all the different generations have against each other.
Yeah.
I'm in the boomer generation and I get frustrated with somebody that's, a block down the hall sending me a Teams message or an email. I'm like, I'm the generation that would get up and go talk to you. Now, if you're remote, I get it. A Teams message, but I would prefer you send me a Teams invitation or pick up the phone. I text a lot, even with my clients, and texting is probably the preferred method if I can't meet with you face to face.
Yeah.
But if the text is going to go back and forth and back and forth, then we should talk on the phone.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is a generational change, and I think even in offices, there are people that will sit there and message back and forth, and the person they're messaging is 20, 30 feet away,
Yep.
and they could just go over and say, "Hey, let's chat about this," or
And get it done. You just get
right,
it off both your list.
yeah. I have a mentor who he has a really neat rule. He says, never deal with conflict via text or email. And he
Right,
said,
because you can't tell the emotion.
yeah. And he tells his employees, he said, "You do that, I will fire you on the spot."
Yeah, I think that's sound advice. At least when you can see each other, you can read the body language and know, what the intent really is.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I've noticed is some people are, they're very brave. They're very bold when they're hiding behind a keyboard. And when you meet them in person, they're a little bit less inflammatory.
Yeah, less confrontational.
Yeah. Well, so let's go back to the lawyers. So what are some of the typical things that law firms struggle with? What are the things that they uniquely struggle with, and what are some things that are kind of common struggles?
The common struggle is keeping enough cash in the business so that the business can invest and grow or even pay the bills in the next few months. Typical firm will get to the end of the year, pay out all the cash, and then live on the line of credit for the first few months. Well, you're just chasing your tail there. And we want to get to a point where you're setting cash targets. How much operating cash do I need? How much do I need to set aside for taxes? On a flow through like a partnership. We're going to have to make distributions to cover the income tax from the entity. And so I want to set that aside as well in a high yield money market so that I can make those tax distributions to the partners. But just the discipline. And once I hit those cash targets, then the next dollar that comes in is truly available for distribution. So it's really short-term delayed gratification so that we can get to a nirvana where we can distribute that next dollar that comes in.
And so for partnerships, and I just want to make sure I'm following what you're saying, partnerships where the taxation flows through to the individual. And I guess when you have multiple partners, you have to basically make a fund where everybody has a basically owns a percentage of that fund that then later gets distributed when they have to pay their taxes, their personal
Right.
income.
And we'd probably distribute that on a quarterly basis. So if they make $100 for the year, we're going to set aside $40 for distribution for taxes and distribute it to the owners in proportion to their ownership. And then we might decide that, hey, 20 of those dollars we need to set aside for operating income. Well, that's only going to leave $40 for paying the other bills and distributing profit to the owners. Now, my example is very simplistic at $100, but you get the concept of setting aside the money so that you don't have to scramble to find the tax money later. And the distributions you get to keep because they're not for income taxes.
Okay, this is fascinating. This is actually kind of helpful. So you said you put it in a money market. Is it not like a index fund or something like that? It's something that's reasonably stable that you know will.
Yeah, you can find a high yield money market account, and it's only going to be there for a few months, right? Because you pay taxes on a quarterly basis, but every month you're putting money into that account, and then you're going to distribute what you have to make your safe harbor estimate. It might not, in a year where your income is going up, you're going to be putting more money in that account than you actually have to make in estimates. But then the following April, when you file or extend, you're going to need that money that was accumulating there to pay your extension payment or your balance due. So it's just a way to make sure that you're segregating those funds so that they're there when you need them. And if you can make 3 or 4%, then all the better.
Do you set it up so that the firm automatically makes those estimated payments, or do the individual partners have to receive it and then make the payment?
The individual partners would make their federal tax deposits. In a lot of states now, we have pass-through entity tax where we can pay at the entity level the state income tax, which is actually better because when I pay it at the entity level, I get a deduction. So in my example of $100 of net income, if $5 is paid to the state, I'm only taxed on $95 as the ownership group because I get a deduction for those state payments.
Got it. Okay. That's fascinating. And that could be really complicated for a law firm because they have a ton of partners.
It can be. And there are very few partners or partnerships, rather, that are all for one, one for all. There's 100 different comp models in a partnership. I do have a few in our client base experience where, especially in a PI firm where big dollars are coming in and a lot of places are eat what you kill. Well, that was my case, so I get the profits from it. And in a partnership, I can allocate away from ownership percentage. But I do have a few that say, hey, Joe had a good year, but we're splitting it 50-50. And next year I'll have a good year and we'll split it 50-50. They're not all ruthless and say, well, this is my book, this is your book. And really, when you have that book of business mentality, you don't really have the collaboration of a firm, right? Because you're really just sharing overhead, saying, okay, I produce this. And so, minus the overhead, I get X. And you produce less, so you're going to get less. We want to build something that we can both win at, or all the partners can win at. And you want to build something that has a younger group of people that can replace you someday.
Yeah, which is challenging because we have an upside down demographic.
We do. But that's where AI can help and not hopefully hurt us. If AI can create some efficiencies, then we can do more with less people. And I'm not suggesting that we just say we're going to use AI to do more. In fact, there's a guy named Zach Kass who co-founded OpenAI and has since left there. And he spends his entire time talking about let's use that excess capacity that we create from AI to reconnect with our family and friends. And he actually goes to local and state governments and says, hey, we've got to create parks and good roads and good schools so that when AI creates these efficiencies, we can reconnect and do good with it and ethically use it.
Yeah, there's some economists that I follow called ITR Economics, and they're
Love that group.
yeah, so they're predicting a Great Depression in 2030.
Yep.
And one of the factors, I think if I'm phrasing it right, they say all countries are going to suffer. Those with the higher birth rates will suffer less.
Right.
And so if us versus like China's really, really going to hurt during that depression.
And we're behind them demographically as far as the birth rate decline, but we have the same issues. They're just maybe years ahead of us.
Yeah. But they said something that was really interesting. That they said, AI is not the threat. It may be the savior for our birth rate issue. That may actually be, a solution that just fortuitously popped up when it did. That as we're having trouble filling these, like wealth managers, one of the problems they're having is they don't have young guys coming up. There's not a lot of certified financial planners coming up through the ranks. The average age of a wealth manager is like 58 years old. And so for places like that, AI may be the savior, not the threat.
Right, because theoretically you'd need less of those coming into the profession to do the same amount of work. It's an interesting thought. I love ITR. Every time they come to town at least once a year and I try and be at their presentation, I think it plays back into keeping your bills paid and keeping cash in your business because you need to be prepared for when that next really bad economic event happens. And they've been predicting this since I've been following them since the early 2011 or so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's morphed a little bit, it's moved a little bit time-wise, but I mean, I remember Alan Boulay saying, "Hey, the 20s are going to be robust and great. Go and, incur a bunch of debt in the early 20s, but make sure it's paid off by the late 20s."
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's well, and they also say, just so for those listening, it's not all doom and gloom. They say if you go into this prepared, this will be your biggest money-making opportunity of your lifetime.
Right. You'll be buying things at a discount if you have the cash.
Yeah.
I tell my kids all the time about ITR, and I don't know that they've listened. Although I do, for years I've been telling them, read Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. My youngest came home from Chicago last night. I picked him up at the train station. He was telling me about this great book he read, Dale Carnegie. I'm like, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. It's funny how you become more wise. Parents always become more wise as the awareness of the kids increases.
Well, and the younger me would have said, I told you. You remember I told you that, but I just let it go.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It's one of your comments about be influential, not overbearing. Back when I was in industry, the best sales guys, so we'd have sales guys saying, hey, the customers are saying this, the customers are saying this. And periodically I'd go out on the road and meet the customers. And a lot of marketers would go out on the road and they're like, they'd hear something there. It's like Moses coming down from the mountain. They're like, I've met with God and I have the oracles of God here in my hands. And I'm coming back to the factory to tell you what the customer said. And the younger sales guys would be like, I've been telling you this for a year.
It
The
just
smarter,
sounded better when they said it.
yeah, but the smarter sales guys, and I was guilty of that too. The smarter sales guys were, they'd sit there and say, "Man, Craig, that was so good that you were able to figure that out." And and I'd sit there and reflect. I'm like, "Oh yeah, they've been telling me for 6 to 9 months."
Yeah.
But
I had
like.
a really good attorney that I was kind of friends with, and we were at a football game. It was a high school game, and I thought that one of the players out there was going to this certain university. And he didn't disagree with me, but the way he said, oh, made me think I was wrong. And so I looked it up like during the next week, and the next week we're at the game, and I'm like, I was wrong last week. And he knew I was wrong, but he didn't point it out at the time. He just planted enough doubt with his, oh, that I went and looked it up, and sure enough, he was right. And it was genius the way he didn't confront me. He just planted the seed to maybe make me go look it up.
Yeah. And I mean, back in your whole thought about being influential and not overbearing, I've seen that also. When I was leaving North Carolina to come to Texas, I was coming to a competitor, and of course, my non-compete had been overwritten. They always are.
Yeah.
And so once we agreed on the job, I said, okay, the last thing is you gotta make my lawyer give me the green light that we're gonna be operating in a way that not violating what the reasonable non-compete is. And so they brought a very senior attorney, employment attorney on the case. And I remember sitting there on a call, and the company's attorney starts telling my attorney, he's like, "Well, hey, if I understand what you're saying right, tell me if it sounds like you're saying that North Carolina has no severability clause in employment contracts. So if part of it's null and void, then the whole thing's null and void." And my attorney's like, "Yes, that's what I'm saying." And he just kind of got, I'm sitting there watching it, and I was like, that is so brilliant. It was just the human side. It was about more than knowledge of the law. It was about knowledge of people.
Right. He was able to read it and get the other guy to come over to his point of view without confrontation.
Well, John, this has been really good. I really feel like we could talk for another hour easily because you're doing something really fascinating. Working with attorneys, I think, is always interesting. And I don't mean that, I'm not being euphemistic. I just think they're an interesting dynamic of people, super, super smart, that have, some unique ways of doing things. And I think it's fascinating. How can people contact you?
Well, you can search the web for Anders Virtual CFO Services or AndersCPA.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, John C. Scott, CPA. I think my LinkedIn profile picture is a caricature of me holding a Kansas City Chiefs pennant. And then I'm on TikTok and I'm also on Instagram for JDC Virtual CFO.
Well, excellent. Well, hey, thanks for coming on Leaders and Legacies.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Craig.
This is Craig Andrews. I want to thank you for listening to the Leaders and Legacies podcast. We're looking for leaders to share how they're making impact beyond themselves. If that's you, please go to alliesforme.com/guest and sign up there. If you got something out of this interview, we would love you to share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you know someone who would be a great guest, tag them on social media and let them know about the show, including the hashtag Leaders and Legacies. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We are regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you don't miss anything, please go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me. It means a lot to my team. If you want to know more, please go to alliesforme.com, or follow me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.